Welcome to another episode of the Mapscaping Podcast. My name is Daniel and this is a podcast for the geospatial community. Today I'm talking with Hugo, a junior information management officer with the global search team at IMAP. IMAP spelt with two M's, very tricky. The goal of this episode is to help you understand the role of geospatial in the humanitarian world, the challenges faced by people preparing and dealing with humanitarian disasters and the tools and technologies they use to do this kind of work. And none of this would be possible without my sponsor, Scribble Maps. Jonathan, the CEO and co-founder of Scribble Maps, has been on the podcast before. It was a fantastic episode. It's called The Business of Web Maps. If you scroll back through the archives, you'll find it there. And here's what Jonathan wanted me to tell you about Scribble Maps. You can use it to augment your current GIS workflows and bring GIS to all levels of your organization. So as I've mentioned previously, this is easier said than done. And notice the word augment. Not replace, not throw away ArcGIS, QGIS, whatever else other desktop GIS you're using, but augment it with Scribble Maps. I think this is really clever messaging. Scribble Maps has more tools and functionality than I could possibly mention here, but if you're interested, check them out. You can book a one-to-one demo with Scribble Maps today and mention Mapscaping for a discount. Still not convinced? Listen to this song about Scribble Maps split/knife tool. That's right, they have a split/knife tool. Take a listen.
Not one but two new tools, slash a knife. First slash lets you cut one or more polygons along a straight line. However, slash has a special superpower. It does not need to cross borders to cut. It can also slash an entire polygon when zoomed in. Second knife, similar to slash, but you can freehand cut. Additionally, you can use it to cut holes in polygons precisely. Go forth and cut and slash.
Thank you, Scribble Maps. I really appreciate your support. Hi, Hugo. Welcome to the podcast. Absolute pleasure to have you with me today. I really enjoyed our last conversation and I'm looking forward to this one. Your title is fantastic. It's the Junior Information Management Officer with the Global Search Team at IMAP. Does this or does this not have anything to do with surfing?
The Global Search, the Wave Search Team. I think it would be a lot more radical if it was to do with surfing. But no, unfortunately not. The global search team is a slightly more dire subject matter than surfing.
Okay, thank you for using the word radical. It's been, I don't think anyone's ever done that on the podcast before, and it's much appreciated. So what does the global search team do? What do you do?
Okay, so the global search team is basically, we have a core group of management. So there's about six or seven of us. But we manage what is known as an information management roster. And within that roster, we have about 200 plus experts who are, you know, kind of cross-disciplinary. So from information management and GIS to web development, full stack, it kind of covers a lot of ground, but it's mostly information management. And during a humanitarian crisis, be it man-made or natural, we will deploy an expert to the field in order to support the humanitarian activities that are going on during that crisis. And for the most part, it's within the UN cluster system. So we, with one of the UN agencies that we're partnered with, they'll make a request and we will then find appropriate profiles to go and support them in the field.
And just to clarify, just so I make sure you're in the right place, this is a geospatial podcast and we've been talking about information management. Is there any geo involved here?
Yeah, so I was confused by this initially as well, but you know, a huge component of information management is GIS. And I say that because, you know, while a GIS expert will be able to do the data analysis, the visualization, the data prep, an information management officer will be able to do those things, but they will also be able to kind of look at the data holistically. So not just from a technical point of view, but be able to say, okay, I'm entering this particular crisis, be it an earthquake or what have you, and they need to know, right, well, we are getting data from six different stakeholders. I need to make sure that it's in the same data format. All right, now I have it all in the same data format. How am I going to contact them to make sure the data comes in regularly? So it's essentially looking at data as a whole, and with humanitarian crisis, geospatial data is key. So an information management officer kind of GIS will come under the umbrella of the roles and the duties that an information management officer will need to carry out.
I'd like to hear a little bit more about your background before we really dive into this topic of what your response is to some of these crises, how you're deployed, the kinds of things you do, the conditions you work under, all of this kind of interesting stuff. But how did you get involved in this? And how did you get involved in geospatial at all?
It was almost by accident, honestly. When I first started GIS, doing GIS things, I didn't even know that I was doing GIS things. I was 24 or so, and I moved to the Democratic Republic of Congo, to the eastern part of the country, so on the border with Uganda and Rwanda. And I was working as the executive assistant to the head warden of Virunga National Park. And people may have seen, there's a famous documentary about the park. But as part of being the executive assistant, you know, my boss was often traveling, or he was out somewhere else in the park, or I had a lot of different roles. And one of the roles that I was doing was supporting the park rangers in mapping various aspects of the park, but more specifically the poaching camps that were set up within the park boundaries. And okay, it is a wildlife reserve and it is there to protect the animals, but the thing that was being poached was actually charcoal. So they would take wood from the forest, from the park, and they would build these big kilns to produce charcoal, because that was realistically what they could sell in the local area. So I was going up with the little tiny fixed wing planes that we had with some of the rangers, and we were taking down coordinates and we were, you know, snapping photos of where these encampments were, and you could tell where they were because of the kilns, so they'd be letting off smoke, and then, you know, bring it back to HQ, and that would then be mapped onto a, you know, super basic map for the rangers to then go and clear up.
Wow. And so after, there's a lot of things in that story that are incredibly interesting.
There's a lot to unpack.
I would like to ask about how you got that job. Did you have it before you left? It seems like a pretty bold move for a 24-year-old to pack up and move to that area. So there's a lot of things I'd like to ask, but I'd actually like to know, how did you get from doing that incredibly interesting work to what you're doing today? That doesn't seem like there's a direct relationship between these two things.
No. In fact, after I came back from the DR Congo, I was at a little bit of a loss for what to do. And it was my sister, who's a marine biologist who had been doing a lot of GIS stuff, who had said, hey, you should do this course. It was an Oxford University continued education thing, a kind of 7-week online course where you learn all about the basics of GIS. So, and I was like, oh, okay, that's what I was doing. And so, you know, my end of course project was mapping the topology of Virunga National Park. And that was when I really realized, like, oh, okay, there's actually something really cool in this. And I grew up in a humanitarian family. My mom worked for the Red Cross, my dad for the WHO. It was slowly but surely, I slowly realized, okay, I know I want to now work in the humanitarian field or the human development field. This GIS stuff is quite unique and it's a unique skill. And so really, yeah, it was little by little, slowly building up the skills and understanding of both the humanitarian and GIS world that kind of made me take this approach overall. Yeah.
I can imagine there's been a lot of need for people like you that have your kinds of skills to be deployed. So we're talking about the global search team, you're deploying these people. Have you yourself ever been deployed?
Yes. So I've done a couple of deployments with IMAP. I guess the two most notable ones were February of 2023. I was deployed in support of DEEP, which is a knowledge platform, a data analytics platform, with the OCHA ANA cell during the earthquake in Turkey, Syria. And then more recently, I was deployed in support of UNDSS Jerusalem, which UNDSS is the United Nations Department for Safety and Security. And I myself and a colleague of mine were deployed to help support their incident reporting system.
What does that even mean? Incident reporting system.
So in the humanitarian or conflict context, an incident can be anything. So it can be kind of on the very small scale, say a protester arrested by police, or it can go all the way up to, you know, rocket fire landing in particular district or particular area. So incident reporting is essentially what happened, who by, where did it happen? And then from that, you can start making decisions about what kind of support may be needed, where is it needed, and how can it best be provided? And I guess ultimately it's how can it best be provided in the safest way possible for the people that are in the, that are going to be delivering the support or the aid.
Is this a coordinated effort, like this kind of incident reporting? Let's say you were deployed to Gaza now. My guess is people like you are there doing this kind of work. Is it a coordinated effort across several different organizations, or are there multiple organizations all doing this?
Yeah, so within the humanitarian realm, there's what's known as the cluster system. And essentially, it's as a means of ensuring that there's, first of all, no like double up on work, but it basically ensures that there is one central agency that is going to be coordinating all of the other ones. For example, the Ukraine crisis, 260 humanitarian organizations arrived in the field within, 3 days of the fighting breaking out. So you need to be able to have this kind of overall holistic, this overall view of who's doing what and where, and it needs to be managed by one centralized group. So within Gaza, yes, there would be one organization that is the through line through it all, but within which all the smaller organizations can kind of operate as they would normally, as long as it's, if they're being told, oh, actually, you don't need to do this because this other group is doing that, we need you to do this kind of thing.
In such a deployment, is it typical that you have like one very, very specific task, go and map rocket launches, for example? I'm just using that just as an example. Is that typical, or is it go and map any sort of incident that you see, go and map, tell us where the roads are blocked, tell us where the roads are open? I'm just trying to get a sense of what your day-to-day might look like. What kinds of tasks are you expected to carry out?
So in this particular deployment, we had a very specific task. There was a very specific request. And that was, they had this very outdated data collection system that involved a bunch of Excel files that fed into each other and then produced the analytics. And we were brought in because they were like, well, this is untenable. Like, we can't keep this up, because every time that I run the analytics, my Excel will crash. The only reason I know what that means is because I've been told that that means it's an error. There's an error in the data input. So for the deployment with UNDSS Jerusalem, that was the problem, the very specific problem of, we need to gather data, but every single time I'm then going to do the processing, it crashes my computer or it doesn't work. And then I basically, the person then basically needs to go through the whole thing again and make sure that the data is correct. So in that particular one, yes, it was a very specific demand. However, it's not uncommon for crises to just need an information management officer, or, a very generic, we need a GIS officer whose expertise is mapping. And in those circumstances, it's because, as the name suggests, there is a surge in demand for those particular types of products. So all of a sudden, they may not necessarily need a full-time data manager, but during the next 6 weeks, we anticipate needing to be able to do X, Y, Z. We don't have the capacity. Please send on someone who can essentially hit the ground running, because they have experience in the humanitarian realm, because they have experience with data, and they can just say, okay, you're with the health cluster. I know the health cluster uses X, Y, Z templates. We're going to create the contacts list of everyone involved in the region. We're going to generate a surveying tool. We're going to create a dashboard, and it's like, boom, boom, boom. This is what needs to be done. Here, I'm here, I'm going to do it. So it can really depend. Sometimes it's very broad. Sometimes it's very generic. Sometimes it's very specific.
So I've worked as a geospatial specialist for a bunch of relatively big organizations now. And what struck me about what you just said before was this experience in the humanitarian realm. And my guess is, you're going to have access to different kinds of tools, and it's going to be in a very different situation than the situation that I was in when I was working for a big corporation. I had access to all of the service that I want. If I wanted some software, I could just apply for it and get it and run it. I could take advantage of cloud processing, all of these great things. And I could be wrong here, but my guess is this is not always possible when we think of responding to a humanitarian crisis, because it's a crisis. Maybe you don't have internet access, for example. Maybe you don't have access to all these tools. Maybe you don't have the kinds of budgets that I was privileged enough to work with. Am I correct in thinking that way?
Yeah. Oh, sweet, sweet summer child. Yes. I mean, for us, a lot of times when you're being deployed, having internet is great. Being able to access the internet is a massive, massive deal. And, one of the big things you do before being deployed is you make sure that you have a USB stick or on your laptop, you have all of the readily available data on a particular region so that you can immediately have access to that and create, you know, baseline sit reps, situation reports straight away from offline data. So it's very rare that, I would really love to be able to do this, you know, massive data processing, and I know that I can do it with FME. I don't think I could go to any organization that I've been deployed with and say, hi, I need an FME license, and then get it within the time frame of a particular crisis. It's just too difficult to get that kind of support or even the budget for it, you know?
So what kind of tools are you working with? I think a lot of us will understand, that would make a lot of sense. If you can get a hold of this data, sure, download it onto your machine and take it with you, and then you can use it offline.
Mm.
What would be a typical stack that you would take with you? Like, what are the kinds of tools that you would be expecting to use in this kind of humanitarian response?
Yeah, I think as with a lot of GIS, I'm sure in the private sector as well, there's a kind of big divide between the open source versus proprietary. But I would say for the vast majority, it's generally always open source. QGIS for mapping and data analysis, I'd say, was fairly core. And then a fair amount of what are they called? The business analytics tools. So like Power BI and Tableau, those get thrown around a lot. But as I mentioned, so right at the start, you would have all of your baseline data on a USB stick. You then need to have the data from the field. One of the core tools that people use would be things like ODK Collect, which is an open source application on Android, and then Kobo Toolbox, which is another one, which is fairly widespread, but like it's an open source surveying tool. And those tools, I'd say ODK, Tableau, and QGIS were the three core humanitarian GIS information management tools, without a doubt.
Could you just run those ODK Collect and Kobo Toolbox? Could you just go into a little bit more depth there, please?
Sure. So Kobo Toolbox, if you're familiar with Survey123, it's not too far off from that, but it's a spreadsheet-based surveying tool with geospatial capacity. So you can use it to map any kind of quantitative and qualitative data alongside each other, which makes it super helpful for doing things like needs assessments. So you can go into a refugee camp, for example, and you can go systematically tent by tent, and you can ask them, hi, what's your name? Where are you from? How big is your family? And then find out what their needs are exactly. Because then you can then map that, and just using, you know, simple heat maps or chloropleth maps, you can start making an understanding of the layout of that particular refugee camp, or how it's changing, or how are the needs reflected in where they are placed in the camp and who is around them. And yeah, so it's not far off from Survey123, but it's open source. And so you can make any changes that you might need, and it's offline operational. And then you can also have it linked to servers. So you could then have multiple enumerators all gathering the same type of information, which once they can then get to a place where there is connection, it can then all be uploaded straight onto a server, and the analytics can be done.
That sounds really cool. I'll put a link to that in the show notes so the listeners can check that out. That sounds really interesting.
It's a great tool in pretty much every single humanitarian context that I've worked in. Kobo Toolbox comes up.
What about the data side of it? Is there any particular place you're going to get your data? Or what would you consider to be like a package of data that you would take with you? What are the kinds of things you would be interested in having on that USB stick?
Yes. So OCHA, which is the United Nations Organization for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs.
Whoa.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, the humanitarians love a good acronym. So there you go. There's one for you. OCHA, I will refer to them as. They have a geospatial platform called HDX. And HDX stands for the Humanitarian Data Exchange. And essentially, it's a widely available database focused on humanitarian relief. So if I was to be deployed to any given context, I think the first place that you go to is HDX, because IMAP, for example, we contribute to HDX with our data, but you know, we also gather data from there, and all of the humanitarian organizations, if they have a GIS or data component, I almost guarantee that they will be uploading there. And if they aren't, shame on you if you're listening. You should be uploading to HDX because it's one of the most important tools in terms of information sharing within the humanitarian community. So, you know, IMAP as a tech-based organization within the humanitarian world has, you know, benefited from it greatly and contributes to it as well. So that would be the first place. But then, you know, there's lots of other tools which may have more accurate information. So there's the Humanitarian OSM team, who I believe you've had on this podcast already.
That is correct.
I listened to it the other day. Yeah. So the Humanitarian OSM, Hot OSM, are great because they, you know, most of it is volunteer based and they just have some, you know, incredibly powerful crowdsourced data, which, as we've learned, can be even more accurate or useful than the normal, you know, means of data gathering. So I would, HDX and Hot OSM, those are the two core places that we would look. And then if you have the access to the Esri suite stuff, then there's always going to be things on Living Atlas. Is it called World Atlas?
I think it's Living Atlas. I think.
Yeah, Living Atlas. That's it. You get a lot of natural disaster information from Living Atlas. So for example, for earthquakes, that data is almost immediately available as a super comprehensive layer. And then finally, the one that I like to use, this is my little personal recommendation, is the PDC, which is the Pacific Disaster Response Center. They're great. Based in Hawaii, Joel Murr, who's the boss there, is brilliant. And they've got some great information.
I'm curious, are any of those sources of, you know, imagery, raster data?
For the most part, no. PDC, yes. Hot OSM, to a certain extent. Building footprint is often available. But for the most part, it's going to be, you know, vector data. Yeah.
In terms of, like, so you mentioned building footprints there, have you come across the Overture Foundation?
The Overture Foundation?
Yeah.
No, I haven't.
This, you should check that out.
Okay, I'm just noting that down.
Yeah, it's worth a look. So my understanding is that what they're doing is they're taking OpenStreetMap data and then augmenting it. You know, if there's things missing in OpenStreetMap, they're going to find another data set and they're going to try and sort of weave those two things together. Oh. So a lot of machine learning-based data sets, you know, the reason why I remember this was because you mentioned building footprints there. So where OpenStreetMap is missing building footprints, they'll sort of augment that with, you know, existing building footprints databases that come from machine learning data sets.
Oh, that's brilliant.
It'd be worth having a look at and just seeing if any of that information could be useful to you.
No, definitely. Oh, thank you very much. That is going into the research pile.
Oh, good. Yeah, I hope it's helpful. Appreciate you listing off those tools there. That's really interesting. There was a bunch in there that I hadn't heard of before. So I will put links again to those in the show notes of this episode so the listeners can check them out too.
Actually, yeah, there was one more I wanted to mention. Sorry.
Please.
And it's our own.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah. So we have the Humanitarian Spatial Data Center, which while is not necessarily 100% producing its own data, it is a data aggregate. So it not only has a lot of the data which you can then access and download, but it also does a lot of the processing and analyzing kind of built into the dashboards and the product itself. It's been deployed most successfully in Afghanistan. And it's essentially an all-in-one toolbox that has kind of data accessibility, data processing, dashboarding, and visualization kind of all in one place. So that also takes from data that IMAP ourselves have been collecting over the years. So
how would I get my hands on that data if I was interested? Where would I go?
So you literally type in Humanitarian Spatial Data Center to Google, and I believe it's the first thing that pops up.
Perfect.
And then when you're on there, you can you make a request and you then get a login access. With pretty much all of these tools, that's the way it works with the humanitarian realm. You make a quick request and off you go, except for HDX, which I think is just available.
Okay. So we talked about some of the work that you do when you think about responding to a humanitarian crisis. You've given a few examples there, which personally I thought were really interesting. Talked a little bit about the tools and some of the expectations, like what you will have available when you do this kind of work. And super interesting to hear about a lot of these data sources. I did not know that they existed. I'm wondering if we could talk a little bit more in depth about tech. And I have a feeling I know what your answer might be, but I'd like to hear it anyway. Cloud native formats, you know, cloud processing, edge computing, AI, these are the kinds of things that they take up a lot of space in the geospatial landscape at the moment. You know, people talk about this and they're wondering how they're going to apply these technologies. Like, given this sort of context that you put your work in before, saying, oh, we don't have access to this and this is a bit difficult, and you know, there's an expectation that you show up on scene on site with, you know, data on your laptop ready to go and using these open source tools. Do you see any benefits from these kinds of technologies in terms of your work?
Yeah. I mean, I will say I wish we did, but you know, it wasn't long ago that most of this data was still being collected with a pen and paper, simply because there wasn't access to having even just an Android phone. So the fact that we can move from pen and paper then being collated manually and then put onto a digital system, the fact that we can do that straight away with a telephone, that's already huge. Having AI, having image processing, you know, you're using a neural network to identify at-risk flood zones. Okay, that all of that is great, and it's really great in the kind of preparedness phase of a humanitarian process. But during a crisis where we at the search team and the people we deploy work, I mean, it's borderline impossible to deploy, you know, a neural network algorithm or edge processing, because first of all, people won't necessarily know how to use it. And what benefit does it bring compared to, you know, really physically doing the work and getting it done quickly, if that makes sense?
Yeah, it does. But there will be people out there listening to this and they'll be thinking, well, why can't we? Okay, so it doesn't make sense to do this on site, to deploy it on site, to go to these locations. But what about doing this remotely? What about sitting at my comfortable desk somewhere in the Western world with a lot of access to these kinds of technologies? Why not just do it from there then?
Yeah. Okay. So in that context, yes, it does change a little bit. So for example, during the Turkey-Syria earthquake, myself and two of my colleagues were deployed in support of the ANA cell of DEEP. And at that time, yes, it was mostly remote support where we were doing slightly more complex data gathering and data processing. You know, later on, we deployed someone to the field to do a monitoring and evaluation to make sure that what was being done correctly and it was productive. But maybe an example of where AI or image analysis was deployed is that you can use it to measure image change. So, you know, if you have a satellite image of a city from before the earthquake, you can then use image analysis to define, you know, the percentage of buildings that have been destroyed. So that type of thing can be done. But is that type of thing useful within the first 48 hours of a particular crisis? Because really, human suffering, reducing human suffering is the goal. But over that longer period, yes, it does become useful, because you kind of have three phases in humanitarian response. You have the build-up, so the preparedness, you have the crisis, and then you have the rebuilding at the end. So how do you then make sure that the development of the region that was affected by a particular crisis is developing correctly, properly, and healthily? And so being able to have a neural network that can go, all right, blah, 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 we identified 6,000 damaged buildings and 2,000 destroyed buildings, that's super helpful. But it can only be done remotely. And you also need to think, okay, it's great to be able to do that here. However, that neural network, it's not trained in a different context, just because buildings are so different everywhere in the world. So yeah, it would be great if we could train one neural network to be able to identify, you know, destruction. But a building in Antalya is not going to be the same kind of bird's eye view footprint as a building in Ouagadougou, for example. So is the amount of effort that goes in worth the output at this point? In my mind, not necessarily. And you can kind of have the same result using open source citizen science, people who can go through and for sure say, okay, on the 6th of December, this building was here. Earthquake on the 7th. And then on the 10th of December, that building is not there. There's a very wide range of humanitarian groups who have volunteers that will come in and do exactly that, spend 3 hours a day. And then we know, because it's a human that is doing the analysis, they can say, yes, this is a damaged building, this is a destroyed building, this is a water center which was working before. This is a water center fully destroyed.
I really want to mention this example that we talked about in our earlier conversation. You had this great phrase. I think it was something like localizing the response. And to illustrate it, you used an example of water distribution in a refugee camp. Would you mind sharing that with us again, please?
Yeah. So the Rohingya crisis, which people might be familiar with, essentially there was a massive influx of refugees into the Cox's Bazar region of Bangladesh. And they were setting up refugee camps. And as they were setting them up, they were setting up their water sites. So, you know, they have these huge 5,000 liter containers of water so that people can have access. And they were setting them up, you know, throughout the camp, no problem. We then have our enumerators go through the camp and they can say, you know, they can ask the questions that, you know, what do you need? What are the things you're missing the most, et cetera, et cetera. And they found as they were going around that even though the water sites were all over the camp, certain people were saying that they don't have enough water. And so what we can do is we can take all of the survey data and, you know, map it. We can then use satellite imagery to get an idea of the refugee camp footprint, so how large it is. And then using, you know, very simple points, we can then place where the water sites are. So with the survey data, we know where people are and the density of the population. With the remote sense data, we can see how big or within the context of the refugee camp where they are. And with the water site data, we know that actually, okay, I'm just going to pluck a number out of the air, but water, these 5,000 liter things are placed, you know, 100 meters apart, equidistant in a perfect grid. And it was found that actually the people that were in the center of the camp were the ones complaining about not having enough water, whereas the ones on the outside of the camp were saying, no, it's fine, there's no problem. And it's just a reflection of the fact that people were arriving in such huge numbers at the start, and there was such a density at the core of the camp that the later arrivals were coming in, they'd have more space or they'd have more, you know, it wouldn't be quite so densely populated. Maybe it was smaller families. And, you know, we wouldn't have been able to know this because if we just had the remote sense data and the points at which you had the water containers, you wouldn't have known because you'd just look at it and be like, oh yeah, no, look, it's perfectly well balanced. Everyone has access to the exact same amount of water, but with someone in the field who could go around family by family and ask the question and could then be mapped. That's what I mean by localizing the information, is that without that kind of information, without solid understanding of what is happening for real in the field by asking questions, you wouldn't have been able to come to this conclusion and people would have suffered.
I think that was a really interesting story. Not because it's like technically difficult to understand or technically amazing, but I think what was interesting for me was the simplicity of it. It's clear that that would not have worked. It would have been difficult to know that there were people that didn't have enough water from a satellite image because, like you said, the distribution is perfect. We can see, you know, people are evenly distributed. The water is evenly distributed. What is the problem? But having someone on the ground walking around, having that local knowledge, a person asking other people what they're missing, you could figure it out. I wonder if you also, do you think about that in terms of like who you're working with, who the people are that are going, that are participating in this kind of work? Are they Western type people like me going to perhaps a third world country or the global South that is experiencing some sort of human made crisis or natural crisis? Or is it people that local to that environment as well that are contributing, that are helping out?
Yeah, no. So I think one thing about IMAP, which I think is just amazing, and particularly our roster for our information management roster with the Global Surge team, is that a vast majority of the people that we deploy are from the Global South. So I've had a couple of deployments, you know, some of my colleagues have had a couple of deployments, but for the most part, when we deploy, a huge number of the members of our roster are from Sub-Saharan Africa, are from South America. It is really, for me, the most diverse roster, humanitarian group, whatever you might want to call it, that I've come across. And so, you know, that also adds an element of localization, because if there is a crisis in South Sudan and you can send someone who is Sudanese, or if there is a crisis in Ethiopia and you can send someone who is Ethiopian or Kenyan or someone who understands the context within which it's working. You then have another layer of experience which can't be taught. Okay, I lived in the DR Congo, but I can't possibly understand the nuances in the context of what it's like to be Congolese. And particularly when we're talking about people who are gathering the data. So there may be an information management officer from our roster being deployed. So let's say there's a crisis in South Sudan, but the people who are then going out into the field to gather the data will be enumerators from the local community. And so you're then transferring very particular skills along to another group of people within a humanitarian context. Yeah, so it is step by step. You are training up people in the local area who hopefully will take an interest in data, who can then hopefully gain enough experience from working with humanitarian groups to then get to the point where they can apply with us to then be an information management officer who can then... So that is something that I'm sure IMAP takes a lot of pride in. I certainly do.
We've covered a lot of ground here. I'm wondering if we can ask a few questions about the future of this. And perhaps we can do it like this. Can you put your finger on like the biggest problem here? Like when you think of responding to these humanitarian crises, what is the biggest problem? Like the kind of problem that if you could just click your fingers, or if you could take my magic wand and just solve it tomorrow, you would. That would be the first thing that you do.
I think if I had a magic wand to solve any particular problem, it would be stop wars. Ultimately, you don't necessarily need the most developed GIS tools if there are fewer conflicts. But I'm assuming that isn't the core of your question, so I will not be facetious. What would be ultimately the easiest thing to solve or the best thing to solve? If I could have a magic wand, I would say kind of a global 5G Wi-Fi connection would go a long way in helping humanitarian response. But not necessarily in the way that Starlink is deciding to do it. It would just have to be local networks function properly everywhere. I think that would solve so many issues.
So you would seek to solve the communication problem. And in doing so, you would give people access to a whole bunch of tools.
Yeah. It would make things like you were mentioning before, cloud computing, feasible on the go, because you could immediately, you don't need the most powerful machine. You could just have your little IBM workhorse and then be able to access, you know, a supercomputer in Switzerland to, you know, process the huge amounts of raster data that you have coming through.
Isn't that amazing what it means? Like just that ability that I can send a message to you and you can send a message back to me and we can communicate in real time. Like what that would solve.
Yeah. I mean, even from a security standpoint, being able to tell HQ, okay, completed the survey sweep of this quadrant, moving to the next quadrant, you know, knowing that an enumerator is safe, you know, being able to have access to the data real time so that you could make the decisions just that little bit quicker rather than, you know, having to wait the 3.5 hour drive that someone's maybe had to do to get to a refugee camp, to get back to a place where there is internet connection. It's those little increments of time that would be saved, yeah.
Yeah, apart from Starlink, is there anything else out there in terms of communication which you think is exciting or sort of has promise?
Oof. No, I'm afraid I don't know. 5G, it's pretty great. There's more and more in sub-Saharan Africa, for example. I mean, this is not news, but it's, you know, it's more convenient and easy to have a mobile phone than it is a landline. And the innovations that are going on with just the telecoms world over there, kind of in the DR Congo and Kenya in particular, those are massive steps. But I am not familiar with any kind of new comms tools that may be up and coming for wide-reaching internet access.
Do you think we're getting better at responding to humanitarian crises?
Yes, almost certainly. It's tricky to be part of the humanitarian world. It's a bit of a double-edged sword because, you know, we're obviously here to do our best and relieve suffering from beneficiaries. That is the core goal. But the trouble is, the moment something goes wrong, it is hellfire. A humanitarian organization, it has to be so careful about what it does, how it operates, how it approaches issues, because ultimately we have this mantra of do no harm. And ultimately you have to make sure, is what you're doing going to cause more harm than good? Super rudimentary example. Yeah, it makes sense to go and give out food to people who are starving. Okay, but now this protracted crisis has been going on for months, now years. You're constantly giving out food. Well, what happens when that protracted crisis ends? How do you make sure that they're not just reliant on the food that is being given out? And so these kind of lessons have been learned very slowly and sometimes painfully over the last 100, 200 years. And it's getting to the point now where once the juggernaut of the humanitarian world comes into action, once it starts, the cogs start turning, it is efficient and it has that understanding and that local context to, for the most part, be able to say, is this going to do more harm? No. We believe that the processes that we have developed now will do more good than harm. And obviously there are outliers and there are horrible people in any given context. But for the most part, humanitarian response has been improving, you know, leaps and bounds. And, you know, GIS has played a huge role in that because a fun anecdote, the founder of the International Committee of the Red Cross, in his book, Memoirs of Solferino, where he witnessed the atrocities of a battle in northern Italy, Napoleonic battle. The first page is a map. And I always find that is such a powerful image for GIS in the humanitarian sphere, is that the godfather of humanitarian relief and humanitarian aid, first page of his book, is a map detailing that battle.
That's really interesting because it could have been almost anything else, right? Anything else, or a lot of other things would have made sense in that context there to put it at the front of the book, but a map. Interesting.
Yeah, and it's a great map. It's the Soho cholera of the humanitarian world.
Ooh, nice reference to Jon Snow.
There you go.
Well done. I'm really pleased to hear you say that organizations are getting better at this and we have a relatively smooth, maybe not smooth process, but we have a process. We have people have thought about this. They're learning from their experiences and we are getting better at responding to these disasters, to these crises, because my guess is there's going to be no shortage of them going forward. So it's great to hear that we are getting better at this stuff. We've talked a lot about, you know, the kinds of jobs you do and the kinds of tasks you're expected to do and the kinds of context you're expected to do them in. What do people not understand about responding to these crises? What are the kinds of questions that you get on a regular basis when you tell people what it is that you do?
What are the types of questions? Oh, whew. I think a lot of people say, why do you do it? And for me, it's a relatively straightforward answer of, well, I want to help people who are, you know, in tricky situations. Oh, you've kind of stumped me there on that one. I think it's difficult because I am more or less, I live in Switzerland. I live in Geneva. So everyone around me is in some way involved in the humanitarian sphere. So when I do mention that I'm doing humanitarian mapping, there is a baseline level of knowledge. But maybe you could rephrase the question?
Yeah, I think there was a fair response that you gave there. And I think maybe a more helpful question would be, let's pretend for a second I'm a geospatial expert. I'm listening to this. I think, yeah, I would also like to help people. I would also like to get involved. What is it that I could do? Where should I go to do that?
Well, I mean, I would be remiss not to put IMAP forward, but we have our roster. So once a year, we do a call, an open call for people to apply. So if you're information management, if you're GIS, if you're even, you know, more on the coding tech side of GIS and information management, that's great. Then you can apply and you can join our roster. And by joining our roster, you then will receive alerts saying, we need someone with this profile to go to this location or, you know, support this location remotely. And here are the terms of reference. Here are the things that are expected of you. You know, they're often short. So it's 1 month, 6 weeks, three months to 6 months, I guess, is the average. You can then, you know, apply. And when the partner organization that has made the request sees the profiles, then they can say, yes, this person we think will be good. And you're then deployed. So I would say that is a great place to start. It would be to join IMAP, check out our website. But then the other place to start is just volunteering. There are loads and loads of humanitarian activities in the GIS world that are volunteer-based. So, you know, joining, for example, there's a group called Carte ONG. I can give you a link to that. And they have a volunteer network, which, you know, groups regularly call upon if they need any kind of information. So when I was at the ICRC, we needed to know the location of all of the National Society offices in and around Ukraine. So in Poland, Belarus, Romania, all of the National Society offices. And so we activated Carte ONG, who provided 21 volunteers. And I'm telling you, within 3 days, they had developed a data set with like 600 points on it from trawling the internet to find this information.
Wow.
Yeah. And so I'd say just join that. Join a volunteer group. There are so many out there. GIS humanitarian volunteer. Those are the Google words. And something will come up.
I think that's probably a really good place to round off this episode. Thank you very much for your time, Hugo. It's been really great talking with you. Appreciate it.
Thank you so much, Daniel. I really appreciate you having me on this episode. And I mean, I hope it's something new for the listeners, because I know that I listen to this podcast on the regular, and this is, yeah, hopefully an eye-opening topic.
Well, it definitely has been for me. And like I say, there'll be a bunch of links in the show notes to this episode. So listeners, check those out, please. Thanks very much, Hugo. It's been great. Really appreciate it.
Thanks, Daniel. Bye-bye.
So I really hope you enjoyed that episode with Hugo, Junior Information Management Officer at the Global Surge Team at IMAP. IMAP with two M's. So that's IMMAP.org. Hugo mentioned a bunch of different tools and data services that he uses. I'll put links to all of those in the show notes today so you can check them out there. I'd also like to mention that you also find links to other valuable resources in the show notes today, so please take the time to have a look. I will link to a couple of relevant podcast episodes that I think you might find interesting if you enjoyed this one. And remember that amazing song I played at the start of the episode? The song written or produced by Scribble Maps to help people understand what their split/knife tool does. I'll also put a link to that in the show notes. Again, thank you very much to Scribble Maps. If you are looking to augment your current GIS workflows and bring GIS to all levels of your organization, perhaps Scribble Maps is the tool that you have been looking for. It offers collaborative map editing, business intelligence, annotations, and to be perfectly honest, way more tools than I can possibly mention here. Book a one-to-one demo with Scribble Maps today and mention Mapscaping for a discount. Okay, that's it for me. That's it for this episode of the Mapscaping Podcast. I'll be back again soon. I hope that you'll take the time to join me then.